And now, welcome to Oasis Forum, where we explore issues that can help us positively evolve our lives, our society, and our planet. Oasis Forum features authors, activists, artists, and healers working to increase our appreciation of the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Each week, we explore a new topic that impacts our health, our families, our communities, our work, and our environment. Our goal is not just to discuss present challenges, but to develop an awareness of root causes and, importantly, to explore potential solutions. At Oasis Forum, our aim is to inspire hope and share practical ideas for creating a world that works for all. And we are happy to have with us here this evening by phone, Richard Heinberg, the author of Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, and of the earlier book, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, as well as the author of several other books. In the book Power Down, Heinberg says, if the U.S. continues with its current policies, the next decades will be marked by war, economic collapse, and environmental catastrophe. Resource depletion and population pressures are about to catch up with us, and no one is prepared. The political elites, especially in the U.S., are incapable of dealing with the situation and have in mind a punishing game of last one standing. The alternative is, according to Heinberg, power down, a strategy that will require tremendous effort and economic sacrifice in order to reduce per capita resource usage in wealthy countries, develop alternative energy sources, distribute resources more equitably, and reduce the human population humanely but systematically over time. While civil society organizations push for a mild version of this, the vast majority of the world's people are in the dark, not understanding the challenges ahead, nor the options realistically available. Power Down speaks frankly to these dilemmas. Avoiding cynicism and despair, it begins with an overview of the likely impacts of oil and natural gas depletion, and then outlines four options for industrial societies during the next decade. These four options are last one standing, the path of competition for remaining resources, power down, the path of cooperation, conservation, and sharing, waiting for a magic elixir, wishful thinking, false hopes, and denial, and finally, building lifeboats, the path of community solidarity and preservation. Finally, the book explores how three important groups within global society, the power elites, the opposition to the elites, the anti-war and anti-globalization movements et al., the other superpower, and ordinary people are likely to respond to these four options. Timely, accessible, and eloquent, Power Down is crucial reading for our times. Welcome, Richard Heinberg.
Yes, it's good to be with you, John Michael.
Thank you. And before we get into discussions of your book, Richard, I would like to ask you to describe the subject area you teach, human ecology, and how it has brought you to your current work as the clarion caller for the decline of fossil fuel in our times.
Right. Well, human ecology is the study of the relationship between people and the environment. And, of course, the environment also includes other species, so it's also a study of the relationship between human beings and other species.
Mm-hmm.
Human ecologists talk a great deal about population and resources, and I've been trying to understand for many years a particular phenomenon in human history known as the Industrial Revolution, because in everything else in human history is pretty easily understandable. You know, we've been living as hunters and gatherers for tens of thousands of years, and then we discovered agriculture, and that led to all sorts of interesting developments. We started living in larger communities, and because we could produce more food on a given area of land, that also led to periodic food surpluses that were then stored, and then storage of food led to political organization, because then somebody had to redistribute the food, and then there was problem of raids, because now that there was something valuable to raid, people, you know, when one group of people was starving, they would raid another group, and, mm-hmm. and that helped lead to political organization. All this is understandable, okay,
yeah.
Until we get to the Industrial Revolution. Then suddenly everything just goes crazy. The human population goes from a few hundred million to 6.5 billion in the space of 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like that in previous human history.
Right.
We fan out across the planet and inhabit every inhabitable ecosystem. So I started studying this, and you know, clearly we usually discuss the Industrial Revolution in terms of inventions. Okay, we invented the railroad, and we invented the steam engine, and we invented the light bulb, and all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But what we tend to overlook is that all of those inventions run on energy. So what the Industrial Revolution has been about, as much as invention, has been the availability of cheap, readily available energy sources like coal, oil, and natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't been for coal, oil, and natural gas, there would never have been an Industrial Revolution, and we would all be living in small rural communities with just a few small cities
mm-hmm.
scattered around the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for those who are not familiar with this topic that we're going to be talking about mostly here is peak oil, would you please define the term peak oil?
Yeah. Okay, well, the last 150 years of Industrial Revolution have been about having more oil every year, because we've gone out and we've explored for the stuff, we've discovered it, we've built more intensive ways of extracting it, and we've explored the whole planet. And so every year we've had basically more oil, more coal, more natural gas available for us to use, and that's created industrial growth. But the problem is, of course, that these are non-renewable resources. There's only so much that nature has produced for us. And so here in the U.S., we peaked in oil production back in 1970. And that's a historic fact that most Americans maybe know a little bit about vaguely, but never have really thought about.
Right.
See, the U.S. was where the oil industry started back in the mid-19th century. And the U.S. was the world's foremost oil-producing nation, the world's foremost oil-exporting nation for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But we peaked in discoveries here in the 1930s. After about 1930, discoveries fell off. And then about 40 years later, in 1970, oil extraction peaked and has been declining ever since. And that's not because we're not drilling enough wells. It's not because we don't put enough money or effort into it. It's not because oil is cheaper to get from the Middle East. It's simply because we've extracted, by now, about 90% of all the oil that there is to extract from the North American continent. The fact that this is a non-renewable resource is, a matter of more than academic interest here. It means that eventually we will run out.
Mm-hmm.
And the peak phenomenon is due to the fact that this is a resource that is exists in various qualities, and some of it's harder to get out of the ground than other bits. You know, when you first drill an oil well, sometimes it's a gusher and the stuff is under pressure, and it's
mm-hmm.
really easy to get.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're down to the last dregs in the well, sometimes it takes more energy and effort to get that oil out of the ground than it's even worth.
Right,
it takes more energy than the oil will deliver when you burn it.
Mm-hmm.
So that peak tends to occur when about half of the resource has been extracted, and we reached that halfway point here in the U.S. in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, country after country has done the same thing. We've seen about 18 significant oil-producing countries go into first a kind of plateau of production and then begin their terminal decline. And that's been true of Indonesia, which was a major oil-producing country during the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Also for Great Britain and Norway, the North Sea, which was an important oil-producing region from about 1970 on.
Mm-hmm.
This was really good quality, cheap oil to produce, and so we really went after it. And the peak in discoveries occurred in the early 70s, and peak of extraction happened only about 30 years later,
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
2000, 2002. So it's pretty easy at this point to see that there will be a global peak in oil production, beyond which we will not be able to increase the rate at which we extract this incredibly valuable resource we've become overwhelmingly dependent on.
Mm-hmm.
And that global peak in oil production is going to happen probably within the next year or two or three.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to envision a set of circumstances that would push the global oil production peak
mm-hmm.
out past about 2008.
Right.
So when this is an event of absolutely earth-shaking, extraordinary significance. It's something that is unprecedented in our history because we've never been this dependent on an energy resource.
Mm-hmm.
And it's utterly changed the way we live. We've created, you know, cars, planes, and highways and food production and distribution systems, all based on cheap, abundant oil.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not there in the quantities that we're accustomed to, mm-hmm. we're going to have to start changing things and changing them quickly.
Mm-hmm. Our entire food creation and distribution system, and of course trade globalization, which requires cheap fuel to get products back and forth across the sea, all of that will be interrupted as well.
That's right. Yeah, the whole strategy of corporate globalization has been based on the assumption that we'll always have cheap energy to accomplish this with. You know, why is it that we used to manufacture all this stuff in the U.S. and now we buy it from China? Well, it's because they have cheap labor there, but you also have to factor in the transportation costs. Mm. We're transporting all of these we're transporting raw materials to China in many cases.
Mm, that's right.
And then buying the manufactured products and having them transported back here. Well, all of that, you know, it makes sense at a certain level. I mean, you can dispute the wisdom of globalization on many levels, but it all makes economic sense at a certain level as mm. long as you have the cheap energy. But once you don't have that anymore, then the whole program just comes crashing down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what about Saudi Arabia and the Middle Eastern countries and the claim that they have enough excess oil production capacity to meet the demand? Is that true?
Yeah, you know, that's a complicated discussion, and it has so many implications. You know, the Saudis like to say that they have lots of spare oil production capacity because that's really their only source of political clout domestically.
Mm-hmm.
The Saudi royal family is basically kept in power by virtue of oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't want to say that, you know, their oil supplies may be compromised in the immediate future. And then on the other hand, you have the American consumers who see prices go up, and the first people they want to blame are the Saudis, you know, the OPEC nations.
Mm-hmm.
They're wanting to profit here from the oil. Well, you know, all of this is wrong. The Saudis are wrong because even though they say they have all of this spare production capacity, you know, if you look closely, an acquaintance of mine named Matt Simmons, who is the head of a huge oil investment company called Simmons International, has looked very closely at about 200 technical papers from geologists working the Saudi oil fields over the past couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
And he's come to the conclusion that Saudi Arabia is very close to its all-time oil production peak. And in fact, it may already have peaked.
Wow.
The main field in Saudi Arabia, Ghawar, was discovered back in 1949. It's a super giant field that produces about 5 million barrels of oil per day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an aging field, and the Saudis are already injecting seawater into the field to pressurize it. And this is, you know, this is like an oil field on life support, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And once Ghawar goes, then regardless of the other oil fields that are already developed in Saudi Arabia or the ones that may be brought online, once Ghawar goes, Saudi Arabia has peaked.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on that score, you know, we're wrong to assume that Saudi Arabia has all of this oil and can increase production on demand.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, I think we're wrong to blame OPEC for rising oil prices because they're producing flat out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the OPEC countries are in the business of exporting oil. And with the single exception of the 1973 oil embargo, they have produced about as much oil as the world could absorb.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they've been selling it at bargain basement prices. We have seen oil prices over the last 20 years that have been so low that really the OPEC countries themselves, if you look at the per capita income, these mm-hmm. are poor countries.
Mm-hmm.
These are not countries where everyone's riding around in a Rolls Royce.
That's right.
Far from it.
Yeah.
Their per capita income is among the lowest of any countries in the world. So With a few exceptions. I mean, if you look at Qatar or Saudi Arabia, or I mean, not Saudi Arabia, but Kuwait, yeah, there's definitely some pretty high living going on, mm-hmm. at least in some sectors of those countries. But right. if you look at how people on the street live in most OPEC countries, these are not wealthy countries.
Mm-hmm. And we have the whole issue. We're talking mostly about the supply side, but then we have the whole demand side issue of China and India and other countries coming on as industrial powers. Could you say a little bit about how that's affecting the overall picture?
Yeah, well, just in the last few years, China's been coming on very strong. Japan, for, I don't know, the last 30 years or so, has been the world's second foremost oil importing nation. But just last year, China overtook Japan. China has a large indigenous oil production. The Dacheng field is one of the world's largest. And as recently as 1993, China was exporting oil to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But now China is industrializing rapidly. They're buying millions of automobiles, starting to manufacture automobiles in large numbers. And as a consequence, Chinese oil imports are growing very rapidly, and the Chinese are looking for oil in all the same places that Americans are,
mm-hmm.
in Venezuela and West Africa, Canada.
Yeah.
And so there's increasing geopolitical competition for access to future oil supplies. And
mm-hmm.
right at the heart of that competition are China and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been driving up oil prices, too. Both limited supply, the fact that there's almost no spare production capacity anywhere in the world, all the world's oil-producing countries are producing just about flat out as much as they can produce.
Mm-hmm.
And then the demand side is exploding from places like China and, to a lesser extent, also India. And the U.S. is increasing its demand as well.
Sure, yeah. What about natural gas? Is that something that that we can rely on as a substitute?
Unfortunately, no. And there's been a lot of talk about the hydrogen economy lately,
mm-hmm.
As though we could switch over to running our cars on hydrogen easily. And there's a problem with that, which is that most commercially produced hydrogen these days is made from natural gas, because
mm-hmm.
it's much more expensive to make hydrogen any other way, say electrolyzing it from water.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that we can switch over to natural gas is very problematic, because we are, as a nation, we're also peaking in natural gas production. We've been able to avoid a full-blown natural gas crisis over the last 2 years only because of a few factors. We've had pretty mild weather, historically speaking, so we haven't had to use a lot of natural gas for home heating during the winter or for production of electricity for air conditioning during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then natural gas prices have been high. They've been up around $5, $6, $7 a thousand cubic feet, whereas they were at about $2 per thousand cubic feet for years and years, up to about 2000, 2001. So we've had high prices, and that's destroyed some demand.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big users of natural gas is fertilizer manufacturing. Ammonia fertilizer is
made
using natural gas. And with the high natural gas prices, about half of the U.S. Ammonia fertilizer production has been shut down, and now we're starting to import ammonia fertilizer from big natural gas-producing countries overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helped to avert a domestic natural gas crisis. And then the third factor that's done that is just heroic rates of drilling. The natural gas industry here in the U.S. has just gone out and put every drill rig that they have online,
mm-hmm.
to produce absolutely as much natural gas as they can do. And what they're finding now are much smaller fields on average, and they're playing out very quickly. But nevertheless, at this absolutely heroic rate of drilling, they've been able to keep production pretty well flat.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've avoided a natural gas crisis,
mm-hmm.
which was actually predicted a couple of years ago by then Secretary of Energy Spencer Abraham and by Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan.
Mm-hmm.
But that natural gas crisis can't be held off forever, because simply of the geology. We're running out of the stuff. And natural gas is not like oil. With oil, there's kind of a smooth bell-shaped curve of recovery. It peaks when we've extracted about half the resource. With natural gas, because it's a gas, because it's easier to extract in that way,
that's right,
there's more of a cliff phenomenon that occurs. You know, when a natural gas well plays out, it doesn't just go quietly into the night. It just stops.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we may be approaching that kind of phenomenon here in the U.S., where our natural gas production doesn't just start to taper off at 1% or 2% a year, but really goes into steep decline, and that's going to be a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've also talked about there being 50 years of coal left in the United States. What are the pros and cons of further exploiting this resource?
Well, of course, coal is nasty stuff to take out of the ground. It's environmentally ruinous, and then burning it is also environmentally ruinous. It's a major contributor to the greenhouse effect. But all of that aside, how much coal do we really have?
Mm.
If you just look at the total amount of the resource, we have hundreds of years of coal. But again, coal is not so much like natural gas. It's a little bit more like oil in terms of its variability of quality and the difficulty of extracting it. So if you do a Hubbert curve analysis of coal, which has been done under a contract from the U.S. Department of Energy, the rather disturbing result of that is that U.S. coal production is likely to peak within as little as 20 years.
Mm.
So if we were to put in place a huge infrastructure, which we would have to do,
right,
for converting coal into other usable fuels like synthetic motor fuel and so on, that would take many years to produce that infrastructure. It would take hundreds of billions of dollars of investment, probably trillions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
What we would have at the end was a dependency on yet another non-renewable resource that would be peaking within 20 years of today.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, to do that would be the height of insanity.
People tend to, you know, gravitate towards these supply-side and technologically-based solutions. I was reading just yesterday and a group of folks in Alaska that had, I guess, seen the end of suburbia, and one woman from the Marine Stewardship Council said, if every household in America put in a renewable bulb, it would be equivalent of taking 7.5 million cars off the road. Is that a realistic statement, and how is it that we've become so dependent on technology-side solutions?
Yeah. Excuse me. Well, we've become accustomed to supply-side solutions because, well, for two reasons. One, because supply-side solutions don't require us to change the way we live. They don't require anything of us.
Right.
And the second reason we've done so is because we could. Now, certainly, people are going to continue to prefer supply-side solutions, but the question of whether we can implement them is now coming to the fore, because there's a real question as to whether there is another energy source that will be available soon that will be able to supplant fossil fuels, particularly oil. You know, oil is extraordinarily energy dense, and it has been extraordinarily cheap. In many respects, fossil fuel energy has replaced muscle power over the last 150 years. In other words, a lot of things we used to do, agricultural work and manufacturing of all kinds, that all used to be done by muscle power, and now it's done by fuel-fed machines.
Mm-hmm.
But the fuel that feeds our machines is so cheap in terms of its energy cost that if human labor were valued accordingly, people could only be paid something like a half cent per hour. Somebody did the calculation, you know, on how many BTUs. A person can produce about 635 BTUs of energy working hard for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And a gallon of gasoline has about 125,000 BTUs of energy in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so do the math, and yeah, you realize that gallon of gasoline is giving us just extraordinarily cheap energy.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is there really aren't any easy, cheap, available replacements, and that means nuclear, solar, wind, all of the others. Yes, I'm a huge advocate. I think we should be investing in solar and wind, biofuels to a certain extent, all of these things. But we can't expect to continue growing our economy, making our American way of life more lavish and fast-paced at the same time. We're going to have to cut back on our energy usage altogether because there simply is not going to be enough to go around.
So let's talk about wind and solar since you brought them up. What is the state of wind and solar? Do we have the infrastructure, you know, at this point reasonably to expand that to meet some of the demand that is going to be lost through the declines in fossil fuel supplies?
Right. Well, certainly there's a lot of sunlight there to be captured, and there's a lot of wind to be captured. So we could grow our solar and wind energy generation capacity quite dramatically from where it is now. The problem is it's going to take us some time to do that, and it's going to take a great deal of investment. Solar is expensive. Wind is becoming more cost-effective, but still, the scale that we're talking about, unfortunately, when many people get into the discussion of energy, they just don't understand the enormous scale of energy usage in America today. It's not just a matter of putting up a few solar panels and a few windmills. Right now, we get approximately 0.17% of our total energy budget from solar and wind combined here in the U.S. So that means if we were to double our current solar and wind capacity and then double that again, we still wouldn't even be up to 1%. And it's taken us 20 years to get to where we are now. So we would have to undertake a truly heroic program of production of solar and wind infrastructure and installation. And then we would have to have ways of distributing that energy. We're talking about trillions of dollars of investment and certainly decades of work. Even in the best case, if the government were to put in an order for a truly sizable order for, say, solar panels tomorrow, we don't have the production capacity to produce that many solar panels. In fact, if you go out and order solar panels today, you may not get them for a year because the world's production capacity for solar panels is just about maxed out. And most of those are being bought, by the way, in Germany and Spain and Japan rather than here in the U.S. because that's where the demand is.
Right.
So we have a long way to go with renewables before they're able to really pick up the slack from fossil fuels as fossil fuels go into decline. And, you know, we should have foreseen this. It's easy to look in the rearview mirror and say, hey, you know, we should have started a crash program 20 years ago so that we would be ready for the peak of global oil production, which is happening virtually right now. But we didn't do it. And so, consequently, we're stuck with reducing our demand. And, yes, we should be increasing what we can produce of alternative energy from a variety of different sources. But we're not going to be able to produce our way out of this crisis. We're going to have to tighten our belts.
What about the biofuels such as biodiesel? I know hemp has been considered as a good source of biofuel. Are they reaching a point where they're reasonably cost effective?
Well, it depends. Is the answer to that. Biofuels currently are produced by way of an agricultural system that is overwhelmingly dependent on fossil fuels. So, yes, I think we should be investing more in research in biofuels. I was just reading an article this morning suggesting there's a new technology, a new patent for producing not ethanol, but butanol from corn and other agricultural products. And the suggestion is butanol, which is more energy dense than ethanol, would be more economical and so on. Great. You know, I mean, we need to be doing this kind of research, and I'm sure that the pioneers out there will be able to make some discoveries that will help with this transition. But here again, the fact is that we only have so much farmland in this country, and we need most of that farmland to grow food for people. So we're not going to be able to turn, you know, millions and millions of acres over to the production of agricultural crops for energy production.
Right, right.
Right now we have about 200 million cars in this country burning fossil fuels. And cars are the most inefficient form of transportation ever invented by human beings. And we've become so dependent on these cars. And that's where the real problem is. We would like, again, a supply-side solution where all we have to do is switch fuels and continue to drive our cars.
Mm-hmm.
But the overwhelming likelihood is that we are going to have to change our habits, reduce the scale of our transportation, reduce the amount of our transportation, the average distance traveled, and speed, and start carpooling, car sharing, creating public transportation infrastructure wherever we still can, because we're just not going to be able to afford to operate 200 million cars at the drop of a hat whenever we have the whim to get into our, you know, 6,000-pound SUV and drive over to the corner store.
Yeah, yeah. I know Representative Jay Inslee, Democrat from Washington, is involved with the new Apollo Energy Project. He talked about it on the floor of the House not too long ago. He paints a pretty optimistic picture of our energy future. With the project recommends aggressive development of solar technology, tax breaks for house and car efficiencies, increased CAFE standards for automobiles and trucks, and caps on CO2 emissions. What do you think about this as a response to what you project as our deficiencies in fuel supplies in the future?
Yeah. Well, I hate to dispute the Apollo Alliance because I think that these are well-meaning people and they're generally going in the right direction. However, I have to say, you know, what they're suggesting is a regime that basically leaves us with the automobile as the main form of transportation in this country and simply envisions ways to make automobiles a little more fuel efficient and to run them, at least a portion of them, on alternative fuels. I think they seriously underestimate the scope and nature of the problem that we're facing with global oil production peak. The automobile, our dependence on the automobile, I think, is the problem in this country. And unless we're willing to face that problem head on and start doing something about that, I'm afraid that the efforts that we put into making our cars more efficient and so on are simply going to put off the eventual reckoning. You know, we would be much better off to put our efforts now into finding alternatives to the automobile rather than drawing out this process of becoming still more dependent on the most inefficient form of transportation ever discovered.
So why don't we move in that direction? One of the chapters of your book is the same as the title, Power Down, in which you talk about conservation, resource sharing, and cooperation. Can you outline some of the basic elements of how you see this working in the upcoming years?
Well, in order to have a society-wide response to peak in oil production, government intervention is going to be necessary. And I'm not saying that this is likely to happen. Quite frankly, I think the power-down scenario is, in many respects, a pretty unlikely scenario. But I think we need to think it through anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were, as a society, as a coordinated whole country, to respond collectively in a coordinated, intelligent way to peak of fossil fuels, what would we be doing? Well, we would have to redesign our urban infrastructure, redesign our transportation system, redesign agriculture. The government would have to support people through the process of retooling of jobs, moving people from cities into rural areas to participate more in agricultural production.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big subject in and of itself because, mm-hmm. Over the 20th century, we went from having something like 70% of the population working on the farm to having something like 2%. And the reason for that was, of course, that we had all this giant agricultural machinery, from combines to tractors and plows and so on, operating on cheap fossil fuels, mm-hmm. replacing human labor because human labor couldn't compete. Even people who wanted to farm couldn't afford to because they couldn't compete with the giant machinery.
Right, right.
So the 21st century is going to be just the opposite. We won't be able to afford to operate the giant machinery and continue to build these giant machines and keep them running. So we will need more human labor in food production. That means more people living rurally. That means moving people out of the cities into the countryside and teaching them food production skills mm-hmm. that their ancestors had, but you know, they maybe never even thought about learning. And many people are not necessarily going to want to do this kind of work, but if we are going to make this transition in a coordinated way, I think the government would have to step in and help with that relocation and retraining process. The government would have to mandate much higher fuel efficiency standards in every aspect of society, mm-hmm. Much higher efficiency standards in building practices and in operating our buildings, you know, keeping the thermostat lower in the winter and higher in the summer. The ways cars are made, the ways cars are used, how can we still get away with having a 6,000-pound machine running down the highway with only one person in the car?
Yeah, I mean,
that's insane. That's so wasteful, it's hardly even mm-hmm. possible to understand. So the government would have to intervene in all of these ways, and people wouldn't like that very much. I think mm-hmm. the only way that would be likely to happen is after prices have gotten so high that it would be obvious to people that if prices went any higher, they simply wouldn't be able to function as a society, and
right.
therefore they would be willing to accept some of these draconian measures in order to preserve some kind of social stability through mm-hmm. through the process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, so far, I don't think the government has shown any likelihood of doing this, any interest in taking on this kind of process.
No, it's too drastic.
And certainly not mm-hmm. in a proactive way, because yeah. that's the best way to do this would be proactively to reduce demand ahead of the peak
yeah.
and begin investing in alternative energy production long before peak of oil extraction.
That's
but,
right.
again, we haven't done this. So I think what's more likely is that we'll see improvised behavior. We will see some towns and communities starting to make much more rational decisions, because it's at the local level where the pain is going to be felt. There will be a lot of people out of work. There will be people hungry because it's going to be hard to produce as much cheap food as we have been doing over the last century if we don't have the same kind of cheap energy.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have people out of work and hungry, and local communities will largely be left to their own devices to figure out ways to cope with this. Mm-hmm. And some will do a much better job of it than others.
Right. Right. You talk to some degree about the Uppsala protocol, the hydrocarbon depletion study group in Sweden. Can you mention just briefly what that is, and if this protocol were adopted, what effect could it be expected to have?
Right. Well, if we were to have a really effective coordinated power down strategy, it would have to be implemented at the international level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, as oil becomes more scarce, the first impulse is to fight over what's left and to compete for what remains, and that's just likely to lead to more and more international conflict, and that in itself will create more economic problems, because as you can imagine, if there's war in the Middle East, then availability of oil from that part of the world will become problematic, and
mm-hmm.
Prices could shoot up much higher than would be the case otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So, if we're going to have international competition, what does that? Or excuse me, if we're going to have international cooperation, what does that mean? It means that oil-producing countries, oil-extracting and exporting countries, would have to agree to extract and export oil in amounts less than their depletion rate.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Saudi Arabia would have to actually tail off in oil exports.
Right.
And then oil importing countries would have to systematically reduce their imports, and then everybody would have to agree as to how to allocate the oil that was actually available.
Mm-hmm.
And this would require agreements between the U.S., which uses one quarter of the world's oil,
right,
and countries like China and India that are trying to industrialize and would like to, you know, take care of their, you know, 2 billion people, and feel that they have a need for that same oil because they're using it much more productively than
mm-hmm.
the U.S. is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, China is importing one quarter as much oil as the U.S. is, and look at how productive they are with
That's
every
right.
unit of energy
right.
that they have available to them. So, you know, a good argument could be made that they deserve the oil more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of that would have to be worked out.
Mm-hmm.
There would have to be complex negotiations going on among the oil producers and oil users as to how to allocate the remainder of the resource.
It's hard to picture that happening with...
picture that happening, but that's what would be required if we're going to power down in a coordinated way.
Now there is a modern example, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to just spend a couple of minutes talking about Cuba. Obviously, they come from a different socio-political frame, but can you say a little bit about what Cuba did in the early 90s after the fall of the Berlin Wall?
Yeah, well, Cuba had been very dependent on oil imported from the Soviet Union. This was one of the main ways in which the Soviet Union subsidized Cuba, was by giving them cheap oil. Soviet Union, by the way, was the world's second foremost oil-producing nation during most of the 20th century. In fact, in some years, the Soviet Union overproduced or outproduced the U.S.
Wow.
Soviet Union was giving oil to Cuba selling oil at much less than the market rate. And it was so cheap, in fact, that Cuba, in many years, just took the oil and turned around and re-exported it at a profit and
mm-hmm.
earned some foreign exchange income. Okay, so the Soviet Union collapses in 89-90, and suddenly oil imports to Cuba go away.
Yeah.
And so how does Cuba respond to that? Well, it's a crisis, and the Cubans call it the special period. And during this time, everybody was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
There was no way to operate all the cars, and, I mean, they had laughable old cars, you know, 1950s model U.S. cars and mm-hmm. a few Ladas made in the Soviet Union and so on. But, you know, there's no way they could operate these cars and their agricultural machinery and produce pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers. And so people went hungry, and a lot of transportation just stopped. So fortunately for the Cubans, they had a number of organic agronomists who had been advising for years that Cuba go organic. Well, nobody had listened to them up to this point, but after the crisis began, Fidel called these folks in, apparently, and said, look, take over the agricultural sector,
right.
do what you can.
Yeah.
And so what they did was they broke up the state farms into small collectives, and they started moving people out of the cities, out of Havana, into the countryside to work on the farms, and by paying people more for agricultural work than they were paying them for office work.
Mm.
And then they encouraged the growing of thousands of gardens inside the cities. So now there are something like 10,000 gardens, vegetable gardens, in Havana, producing
mm-hmm.
food for the people there. So they've moved
mm-hmm.
producers and consumers back closer together.
Right.
And even though the diet for the average person in Cuba is still pretty pretty stark by a U.S. standard, they've managed to avoid the worst of what might have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody actually starved to death, to
mm-hmm.
our knowledge,
mm-hmm.
although a whole generation of children in Cuba grew up malnourished.
Mm-hmm.
And they have remained as a coherent society, and they've basically survived.
Mm-hmm. And they have free health care for everybody, and they still have pretty good statistics about, you know, with longevity and child mortality and that sort of stuff. So
right.
So they're doing something right, obviously.
Obviously there's a whole political discussion there about human rights and democracy and all of this sort of thing. And I prefer to just avoid that altogether and just look at the facts of how they were able to respond to the situation. Now, we in the U.S. have a whole different political system that's going to be very difficult for us to implement the same kinds of strategies that they did there.
Right, right.
But nevertheless, I think it's useful as a certain kind of model.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about growth and debt-based economies versus steady-state economies. I know it's a big subject, and we don't have time to really go into depth. But at one point in the book, you mentioned how community currencies can be helpful, as they have in various times in world history, including during the Depression in the United States and in other countries. Can you talk just a little bit about what this shift? What a steady-state economy is, in case people don't know what it is, and the role that community currencies could play and other aspects for moving towards that steady state.
Yeah. Well, we have a growth-based economy here in the U.S. and throughout much of the world. And the need for economic growth is not just ideological. It's not just that we would like to have more growth for this or that reason. We have actually created monetary systems that require constant growth in order to avert collapse. Now, how this works is as follows. We have a money system in which U.S. dollar is created by the creation of bank loans. Essentially, when a commercial bank makes a loan, it creates that money out of nothing in the process of making the loan. And banks are regulated by the Federal Reserve as to how much money they can create, at what rate they can create it, the process they have to go through. They have to pay the Federal Reserve a certain percentage off the top for the privilege of creating the money.
Mm-hmm.
There are rules about how much they have to have in reserve in order to create loans and so on. But effectively, all of the money that we have, or virtually all the money that we have in circulation, is money that has been created through the making of loans. So therefore, that money is attached to loans and interest.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody is having to pay interest on those loans. Therefore, if the money supply isn't growing, then somebody is not going to be able to pay interest on their loans. Somewhere in this system, people are not going to be able to pay back their loans with interest, and bankruptcies will occur. This is a subject that takes a little while to unpack most people do not understand the monetary system at all. They assume that money is just this stuff that exists and, you know, banks loan it out as a result of somebody else depositing it, but that's not how it works at all. If you pay back a loan that you've taken out from a bank, that money effectively disappears. So if you have lots of people in an economy who are not taking out new loans and, in fact, paying off their old loans or defaulting on their own loans,
mm-hmm.
old loans, that means that money is disappearing, which means that people are not going to have enough money. Money won't be exchanging hands enough within the economy to allow other people to make the payments on their loans. So it becomes a kind of cascading process of economic destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens in a depression. That's what happened in the 1930s. You know, there were still factories. There were still people wanting to work. There were still people who needed and wanted the products from those factories. But the money system had collapsed, and so there wasn't the money to make the whole system work.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to avoid collapse, we need the money system to grow at a certain percentage rate every year so that there will be enough new money created so that people throughout the economy will be able to pay off their loans with interest and keep the whole thing going so that somebody else will be motivated to take out a new loan.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm, right.
You see?
Right.
And the problem with all of this is that when the economy is growing, that means that more goods and services are being created and changing hands.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the last 150, 200 years, that was possible because we had more energy available every year to make that happen. See, energy is at the base of everything. Nothing happens without energy. And in an economy, the U.S. economy, for example, it's 100% energy dependent because if you shut off the energy, nothing, people can't do anything.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, if there's no gas at the gas pumps and there's no electricity when you turn on the switch, people just stay home and starve, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happens. So we've had more energy available every year, and so we've been able to create more economic activity every year. But as energy availability begins to decline, then economic activity will also decline.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't, with our current monetary system, that is catastrophe. So we need a different kind of monetary system that's able to operate on a steady state. In other words, where it's not based on loans and interest.
Yes.
So that even in the absence of economic growth, people will still be able to carry on basic necessary economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way we can do that right now is to create alternative local currencies.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not going to change the nature of the U.S. dollar overnight. That's a big long-term project, and there are a lot of economic forces that would push the other direction if we created a popular movement to try to transform the U.S. dollar from what it is now to something else.
Right.
But it is possible to create alternative local currencies right now, and it's being done in communities all across the country. There are hundreds of local currencies operating around the world right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And during the Great Depression, communities that had local currencies fared much better than those that did not, because
mm-hmm.
they had an alternative to the
right.
national currencies.
Yeah. It should be mentioned here that this is legal and that it's not a substitute for the national fiat currency, but it is a complementary, often called complementary currency or an alternative community currency that works in tandem with the national currency, but especially when the national currencies are not in abundant supply, because it keeps the money local and it keeps that energy circulating in a more localized area.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and people can find out more about that from Ithaca, New York has a pretty well-functioning alternative system. And,
right, Ithaca Hours.
Folks do a little research on the web,
exactly.
Google Ithaca Hours,
yep.
and local currencies. They'll yep. find a lot of information.
So moving along here in your conversation about what to do, and you have a section of the book on building lifeboats, the path to community solidarity and preservation. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that communities can do, and also what you've noticed in your travels communities beginning to do? I know that you spoke at Yellow Springs, Ohio last year and were part of helping them organize a peak oil and community sustainability conference, and that they're really looking at reducing their resource use. And so what can we do? What can we do in local communities to...
Well, smaller communities can do a great deal. If you look at a big city like Los Angeles, it's pretty hard to get through to the decision makers, and
right.
there's so many vested interests, and there's so much built infrastructure that has to be changed or replaced. But if you look at a small community, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people,
mm-hmm.
Everybody knows who's on the city council, who the mayor, and you can call them up, you can have a meeting with them, you can
right.
have a heart-to-heart talk, and it's possible to make changes relatively quickly. I've been speaking in a lot of small towns across the U.S. In the last few months, and I'm very encouraged and heartened by what I see. People are responding to this challenge in very creative ways. They're creating local committees to work on problems of food security, water security, local energy sources,
mm-hmm.
Local transportation. The biggest town where I see this kind of effort going on is in Oakland, California, which is actually a pretty fair-sized city.
Yeah.
And they're starting to look at local food security. They're forming a food security council, and their goal is 30% organic, local food production. And by local, I mean within the city limits of the city of Oakland
mm-hmm.
by 2010. And
wow.
I think that's an extraordinary goal. And,
yes.
And I'm just amazed that they're doing that. But, you can imagine something like that would be a heck of a lot easier in a small town that's already pretty, has a lot of, rural agricultural land around it.
Right, right.
So strategies like community-supported agriculture, I think, are extremely important here, where people actually make a direct contract, a direct connection with their local farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going through Archer Daniels Midland and a half dozen other corporations and middlemen. And so they're supporting their farmer. They're making sure that the farmer is going to stay in business, and the farmer is delivering fresh seasonal fruits and vegetables directly to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just a fabulous economic model, and people who have the opportunity to do that are really very fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is just a sampling of the kinds of things that I see happening. There's an organization called Post Carbon Institute, and people can Google that or go to postcarbon.org on the net.
Mm-hmm.
And Post Carbon Institute has what they are calling post-carbon outposts,
right.
Towns and cities all over the country where people are gathering and in committees and groups and starting to grapple with these questions and these problems and figure out creative solutions. And the great thing about the post-carbon outposts is that it maintains communication between groups in different towns. So
yes.
That if Willits, California has come up with a great idea for local water security or something like that, well, folks in Yellow Springs, Ohio, can hear about that
right.
and benefit from it.
Now, that's critical, I think, in these times. You talk about the New College of California and some of its offerings for helping to move into this new paradigm. Can you talk a little bit about their sustainability programs?
Yeah, well, I teach at New College in Santa Rosa, and our program, which started 7 years ago on culture, ecology, and sustainable community,
mm-hmm.
is all based around environmental issues. But just now we're in the process of revamping our whole program under the rubric of education for a post-petroleum world.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeking to do is give our students the skill sets that will be necessary for them not only to transform their own lives for the post-peak world, but also to be organizers for their communities in helping to make this transition.
Mm-hmm.
And so those skills range from knowledge of alternative energy to knowledge of small group decision making and how to run meetings effectively so that groups are really functional and everybody feels like they're included and their voice is heard.
Mm-hmm.
We spend a day with them on primitive technology, the kinds of skills that everybody had 10,000 years ago, how to start a fire, how to survive in the wilderness.
Right.
If you have that skill,
exactly.
Everything else seems a lot more doable less frightening.
Yeah.
And it's not that we can learn everything there is to know in a day about primitive technology, far from it. The Paleolithic peoples were extraordinarily knowledgeable and skilled about their environments and about the natural materials available to them. And that you can't teach all of those skills in a day, but we can at least plant the seed and get folks started with that.
Right, right.
And we do that in all sorts of areas, from organic gardening and food production to natural home building and energy conservation, a whole gamut of subjects.
That's wonderful, yeah. Yeah, I can see those kinds of schools or satellite schools like that kind of springing up around the different communities to really promote these things that you're talking about. So that's actually pretty exciting as part of what we were thinking about doing here in the Monadnock region. We already have a lot of resources, Antioch and a bunch of other folks, so it's really wonderful to hear you
great
talk
idea.
About that.
Yeah.
And also you talk about seed preservation and other types of things that we'll need to be looking at as well.
Yeah, seed saving. 100 years ago, everybody was saving seed, and people in most poor countries are doing it today. In other words, when they grow their crops, they set aside a certain percentage of their crop to ripen into seed so that they have seed to plant next year. Well, today most of us are home gardeners, hobby gardeners, never save seed. What we do is we just buy
seed
every year from the store.
Yeah.
And increasingly, American farmers are doing the same thing, and they're even being required to do it as a result of the new genetic engineering technologies.
Right.
So we're not going to be able to just buy packaged seed at the store so easily in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extraordinarily important that we redevelop these seed-saving skills and seed banks, local seed banks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a matter of having one big seed bank in the middle of Iowa that services the whole nation. We need to know what food plants are adapted to our own region with its unique rainfall and
mm-hmm.
weather knowledge base that takes years and decades to develop. So in every region of the country, there are old-timers
yes.
who have been doing this for years. And we may not even know who they are. We need to identify those people. They have skills that are absolutely golden.
Yes, yes.
You know, those are the people that whose knowledge is going to be most valuable to us as time goes on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You talk a lot about relocalization and the need to devolve to the local level for a lot of our strategies and the way we do business. And at the same time, you also talk about the paradox of scale, which is that governments need to grow in power and scope and also develop international institutions while at the same time kind of relinquishing some of that power to the local level. How do you see this happening, this kind of dual movement of towards yeah. localization but also towards more democratic international institutions? What do we have to do to get something like this going?
Well, you know, if that were to happen in a benign way,
yes,
it's one thing. But I think that's mostly hypothetical at this point. I think here in the U.S. we're on the path of more governmental control and power.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's more or less inevitable at this point. The decision makers, I think, understand that the consumerist bonanza can only be continued up to a certain point, and beyond that point, the natives are going to grow restless, and so they have to increase their police powers and surveillance powers and so on in order to maintain order as social order begins to break down.
Right.
Now, I don't like seeing that happen. Nevertheless, I think it's more or less inevitable at this point, and I think, therefore, it's even more important that we work at the local community scale because, you know, we're not going to be able to influence Washington policy very much in this kind of atmosphere of increasing consolidation of power, authoritarianism, and so on.
Yeah.
If we're going to respond creatively to the challenge, I think we mostly need to be working at the local community level.
Mm-hmm. So how do these international agreements happen? Do you see hope in something like the World Social Forum for creating an alternative platform for citizens to get together and to assert some kind of authority, whether it's moral authority or populist authority?
Yeah, I think that's those efforts are very worthwhile. I don't think we should expect too much from them because quite frankly, unless the U.S. is on board with those international cooperative efforts,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to get very far. And I don't see that happening anytime in the near future. Nevertheless, I think it's still helpful to have the models out there, and it's important for us in the U.S. to keep in touch with people in other countries and continue to see the world from an international perspective rather than just from a purely parochial kind of American perspective, because we have a lot in common with people in the rest of the world. We have similar challenges that we're going to be facing
right.
as time goes on, and we can learn a lot from them.
Sure. Yeah. Well, they've been certainly living on a lot less of an energy footprint than the rest of us have here in the United States. And
right, yeah. I mean, the Europeans are already using half the energy per capita that we are in mm-hmm. the U.S., so mm-hmm. we have a lot to learn mm-hmm. from them, for mm-hmm. example.
Right. Well, we have such big houses in the United States, and I know that the experiment in Yellow Springs called Agraria, they're looking at reducing the house size to like 1,000 or 1,200 square feet or something like that, and of course with new building materials and techniques and you know, great insulation and low power usage, they're really looking to cut their consumption by 3/4, which is really fascinating and hopeful. It's at least
a
step in the right direction.
That's a very exciting effort that's going on there.
Well,
that's being undertaken by an organization called Community Service that people can find at smallcommunity.org on the internet.
Excellent. So while we're giving internet addresses, how can they find out more information about you, Richard, and about your work?
Well, my website is www.museletter.com, and that's M-U-S-E,
right.
letter. And I have a bunch of essays there and ways for folks to keep track of my mm-hmm. lecture tours and so on.
Right. And I promise to give listeners the website address for a variety of media featuring your work also. Including some audios and videos, you can go to www.globalpublicmedia.com, or is that .org? I'll have to take
I always screw up on that. I'm not sure whether it's
I will click on this and see if it gets me to where I want to go. Anyways, when you get there, just type Heinberg, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, in the search box, and there's a tremendous amount of stuff. Actually, it's .com that got me there. A tremendous amount of stuff there on Richard Heinberg. Also, a lot of other stuff about peak oil. In fact, as I'm right at the page now, I'm seeing some stuff by Roscoe Bartlett, who was just gave a presentation in Washington, and Jim Kunstler also. And so there's a variety of information there, and it's pretty up to date. It keeps people very informed about the latest information. Any other resources that people can look into around peak oil?
You know, I think that's enough to get people started. If they want to just know the information on a daily basis, you know, what's happening with global energy from a peak oil perspective, the best place they can go is energybulletin.net.
Good.
That's a great website.
Energy, and I will have all of these websites posted on the Oasis Forum website, so you can come to that website and check out these different resources just by clicking on the links, and also have links there to some of Richard's presentations and also some of his PowerPoint presentations that go along with them. There's just so much facts, so many charts and other information that I think really enrich it beyond what we can do with audio here alone. So, Richard, I want to thank you for being here on the program this evening.
It's been my pleasure, John Michael.
And you've given us a lot to think about, a lot to work on, and I think some good reasons for hope, because as I've been scouring around and looking at some of the solutions, whether or not we were headed towards peak oil, a lot of these things just make sense from a human ecology standpoint, from an environmental ecology standpoint. If we were to do these things, we'd just be in such better shape, I think, all around.
That's right.
So good luck on your tour in Europe and elsewhere, and we'll look forward to connecting with you again when you come back.
Yeah, likewise.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And you've been listening to Richard Heinberg, the author of Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, published in 2004. Richard, again, is the author of a variety of books, including The Party's Over, and this is Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and also Cloning the Buddha, The Moral Impact of Biotechnology. He goes around the country speaking on peak oil and what communities can do about it. And I also saw him at Plymouth State University not too long ago to an overflow crowd of 350 people. People are really interested in this. They realize that there's something going on and we need to do something about it before it reaches critical stage, not after. So let's get together and talk about it.